Welcome to Season 2 of Inflammation Nation. My name is Gráinne O'Leary. Inflammation Nation is a podcast from Arthritis Ireland aimed at increasing awareness and understanding of arthritis and related conditions. Hello and welcome to this episode of Inflammation Nation. Today my guest is Professor Gay Cannan. Gay is a consultant rheumatologist at St. James's Hospital and a clinical professor of rheumatology at Trinity College Dublin. She's also the Director of Health and Wellbeing at the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland. You're very welcome, Gay, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Can you tell me, first of all, just to kick off, can you tell me a little bit about your own background and, you know, what attracted you to the field of rheumatology?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on today. I suppose I've always been fascinated by medicine. Even when I was a small child, I was clearing out my parents' house after they died a few years ago and found a drawing. I was very into drawing when I was younger, and I found a drawing with the express wish of becoming a doctor. I think it was Snoopy with the stethoscope and the surgical scrubs.
So, do you remember what age you were at that when you did that drawing?
I was about 8, I think. So I still kept it. It created a bit of laughter at the time when we found it. And so I think I've always been interested in other people and their lives and also making a positive difference in the world. And then as a teenager, I spent several summers in Lourdes working as a volunteer in the Acai Notre Dame, which was a space of living quarters for disabled people who were visiting Lourdes. And so that was a chance to chat to people from different backgrounds with different disabilities and help with their basic needs. And I found that I was very inspired by their courage. And it was obviously a very humbling experience. And I think that definitely meant that I was keen for sure on choosing medicine as a career. And then when I was a medical student, I absolutely loved it. I just couldn't wait to put my stethoscope in the chest and hear a heart murmur or hear, you know, sounds in the lungs. And I particularly loved hospital medicine, I think, because of the diagnostic abilities that were present there. In other words, that you could get a history from a patient, examine them, and then have immediate access to lab tests and x-rays and really just put the mystery together and explain it to a patient and hopefully come up with a plan of treatment. And to me, that's what rheumatology is all about. It's actually taking the mystery. So people don't present with a diagnosis. They present with a set of symptoms. And just taking it all together and coming up with something meaningful for the patient and then seeing it work, to me, that's just magic. It'll never get old. It'll never be tiring. Even after more than 30 years in medicine, I just love it. And even when patients have, you know, the same diagnosis, for example, a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, every patient is different. They come from different backgrounds. They present in different ways. And, you know, the ability to form that doctor-patient relationship and have them trust in you and for you to bring them on that journey, hopefully towards a better future for them, is such a huge privilege that I, you know, I'm as happy now as I was the day I started doing medicine.
And thank you for sharing that with us. And of course, the whole area and specialty of rheumatology has changed and developed over the past number of decades. Can you tell us a little bit more about how your role as a rheumatologist and the specialty of rheumatology has changed?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, when I started as a rheumatology trainee in the early 90s, gold was actually still in use, although it was coming out of vogue, and methotrexate was becoming more popular, although there was still that sense that it was a big drug that we had to use carefully. And also the notion of early arthritis and early intervention was also just coming into vogue. So my first year as a rheumatology registrar was in St. Vincent's University Hospital with Professor Barry Brosnahan and Professor Oliver Fitzgerald. And with their support, I set up the first early arthritis clinic in Ireland. And it was, you know, just very interesting to have that notion that this is early disease and we need to be treating it aggressively. And of course, it was also the start of the biologics. When I started in 1994, the biologics weren't yet commercially available, but of course, there was a lot of research going on. So I also participated in some research for my PhD, looking particularly at anakinra or IL-1RA on the synovium of patients with rheumatoid arthritis. And then that gave me the chance to present literally all over the world and to also hear the people who were developing biologics around the world as well. So it was amazing to be there before the biologics, but literally to see how they were developing. So the biologics have been a huge development in rheumatology and have made such a big difference. And also, when I started, you didn't really talk about remission to patients. You hoped that you could improve their symptoms, but you acknowledged that they really had a long road ahead of them if they were diagnosed with an inflammatory arthritis. So the idea that once the biologics came on board, we could actually talk about remission, for me, that is still really amazing.
And just maybe, Gay, just for people listening,
yes,
who mightn't be familiar with what,
sure,
biologics are,
yeah,
can you just explain a little bit about the difference that, you know, that they brought to the treatment of arthritis in terms of, you know, their ability to, I suppose, impact the underlying,
sure,
disease, et cetera.
So
it was different to what had gone before.
So up to 1998, the medications that we had available were steroids, but of course they produce lots of side effects. We had anti-inflammatory drugs, so naproxen, diclofenac, etc., ibuprofen. They were available again as painkillers and anti-inflammatories, but they had a huge number of side effects. We had gold, but it was going out of vogue. We had methotrexate, which was really just coming into vogue, or we were using it in higher doses. But, you know, really all that was happening at that stage was holding the disease if we were lucky and if we got the patients at an early enough stage. But we couldn't really put a significant number of people into remission. Once the biologics came on board, they acted quickly, whereas the other disease-modifying agents acted very slowly. And they also, we found that they could genuinely give patients back their lives so that we could reduce or even obliterate in many cases their swelling, their discomfort, their stiffness, and allow them to really live their lives. There was also less of an impact on fertility, which of course is important for young women presenting with arthritis, where that was always a significant issue. So really, they made a dramatic difference. Back in 1948, when steroids were first discovered, this was hailed as the most exciting thing to happen, you know, the medical profession, and particularly rheumatologists. And I have read, because I'm writing the history of the words people used when the steroids became available. But really, the biologics were even more dramatic because they had fewer side effects and really changed people's lives in a more permanent way.
And I know that one of the things you're working on at the moment is documenting the progress
yes.
of rheumatology and the history of rheumatology in Ireland.
Yeah.
And you're writing a book. So
yes.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, so I became interested in writing the history of rheumatology when I was the ISOR president. I suppose I was conscious of my place in history as the first female president of the ISOR. But then when I wore the really nice chain of office and looked down at the names that were engraved on them, I realized that I didn't know some of them. And in particular, I'd never heard of the first president, who was he was just known by his initials, TJ O'Reilly. So then I asked around and it turned out that almost nobody had heard of him either. And I thought, well, that's extraordinary given that, you know, it was only 1973. It wasn't, you know, really that long ago. He should still be within living memory. So that triggered my desire to start writing the history. Then in addition, my predecessor in the ISOR presidency was Dr. Ronan Kavanagh, and Walter Boyd, who was nearly 90 and was one of the first presidents of the ISOR, had written to Ronan asking him if he would do something about the history. So Ronan passed the challenge on to me, and so I was keen to take it up. But then I discovered that actually there was no documentation and that the early people had unfortunately passed away. And I thought, well, how do I do this? And so I became a bit overwhelmed by the whole notion of it. And it was really only at the start of the pandemic when I woke up on Saturday morning and I was thinking about the whole, you know, change in the practice of medicine and the virtual technology that we could now use. I realized that maybe I could get this project up and going again. And so I used Zoom and other technologies to actually interview people, to get in touch with people. And even though lockdown happened for a large part of that time, I got enough momentum and enough wonderful help from people to be able to get the project off the ground again. And one of the wonderful things I think about Ireland in particular is the fact that we can make connections and people are so willing to help. And so there was a large part of serendipity as well in terms of being able to contact the children and the widows of the past presidents and try and get a picture of the early time when rheumatology was set up in Ireland.
And I believe that the Irish Society for Rheumatology is actually 50 years old this year. Can you tell me a little bit about the motivation to establish the society?
Yeah, so the early rheumatologists in Ireland were Dr. T.J. O'Reilly, who was in Dublin, and he set up the first rheumatism clinic in Dublin, in Ireland, in 1942. There was Maurice McMahon in Cork, Jack Maloney in Dublin, Thomas Gregg and Dermot Roden also in Dublin, and Walter Boyd in Belfast. So in 1973, I guess, we know that there was the American Rheumatism Association, there was the British Association of Physical Medicine, and physical medicine was considered part of rheumatology, but also part rehabilitation. So the idea of having a national society where there was that sense of identity and maybe a sense of advocacy for the specialty was very important. And remember, at that time, there weren't very effective treatments for arthritis. So the idea of having a specialist society to make it more real, particularly in terms of requesting government funding, for example, requesting services and resources, would have been very important. So in 1973, there would have been the British Association of Physical Medicine, which subsequently evolved into the British Society for Rheumatology, and which was pure rheumatology, and then the British Association of Rehabilitation Medicine, simply for rehabilitation. So in 1973, I guess, because there were such a small number of physicians, it made sense to stay together as both rheumatologists and rehabilitationists. And so they formed the Irish Association of Rheumatology and Rehabilitation. And it wasn't only then until the late 1980s that it became the ISOR, the Irish Society for Rheumatology, and the Irish Association of Rehabilitation Medicine.
And I think one of the interesting things about the ISOR is the fact that it was an all-Ireland society. Can you tell me a little bit about that? I think one of the things that's remarkable about this is that, you know, this society was established in 1973 in the midst of the Troubles.
Yeah,
Did your research uncover any further information about that?
Absolutely. So I did have the privilege of talking to Dr. Walter Boyd before he died. He died in his 90s. And so I went up to Belfast with Dr. Gary Wright, who's also a Belfast consultant. And we spent a wonderful day with him and his wife, Kathleen, talking about the early days of the ISR. And so the idea of North and South being united in the sense of rheumatology and rehabilitation was hugely important. And you'd really have to admire all of the individuals who were there at that time, because, of course, crossing the border in the early 1970s or subsequently until the peace agreement was really no small feat. You know, cars would be was stopped by the British Army sometimes, so it would be searched. It's not a journey you would ever have undertaken lightly, I would imagine. But the sense that it was an all-Ireland organisation was actually part of the core principles. Barry Bresnahan was very keen on that, and when I was working with him, would have said it often. And also some of the early members of the ISOR or IAOR were also part of the Corrigan Club, which was also an all-Ireland organisation set up by physicians specifically to cross the border and promote collegiality on both sides. So the fact that it was all-Ireland, an all-Ireland organisation, was very deliberate.
Thank you. That's very interesting, really, to hear that at a time when, you know, cross-border initiatives weren't that common.
No, they weren't. Absolutely. But that was a really important aspect of the ISOR, and it continues to be. We very much value our Northern Ireland colleagues, and of course, in my book, you know, the Northern Ireland story is a very significant part of it.
So, moving on a little bit, we in Arthritis Ireland also celebrated our 40th anniversary recently, and Professor Barry Bresnahan was actually the founder of the Arthritis Foundation of Ireland, as it was known then. And I suppose the organisation has provided a vital service to living to those living with arthritis and raising awareness of arthritis. Do you feel that this was also a turning point in the history of rheumatology services in Ireland in terms of providing, you know, supports to patients?
I definitely think it was, because in the early days of the ISR, we'll call it, that was very much focused on the specialty. It purely contained doctors. There weren't nurse specialists at that time, or anybody indeed who necessarily specialized in arthritis other than doctors. So the idea that the patient would have a voice and that there would be a specific advocacy for patients was very important. And of course, I'd like to acknowledge the early founders of the of Arthritis Ireland. So there was, of course, Barry Bresnan, but also, I believe, Jack Maloney, Rory Comerford, Mick Malloy, Owen Casey. And then I understand that the first chairman was somebody called Joe Malone, who was a businessman. And together, they made big efforts to fundraise. They developed the first rheumatology day centre in St. James's through the Arthritis Ireland funding. And I believe in Cork, they created a hydrotherapy pool. So really important resources for patients.
And if I move back to kind of looking at the significant developments, you know, that have happened in Ireland. So we've talked about the treatment of arthritis and the advent of biologics, et cetera. But what do you believe are the most significant developments that have been made in the provision of rheumatology services, maybe over the last, you know, 50 years, you know, in terms of looking at the research that you've been involved in recent
Sure.
years as well?
Well, to be honest, I would say that the first most important set of developments was actually an increase in resource. And maybe that was as a function of the ISR and Arthritis Ireland to actually be a set of bodies willing to advocate and to say, we're here and these are the things we need. Because there were certainly many presentations to the Oireachtas Joint Health Committee advocating to politicians, creating the noise, if you like, that patients with arthritis and other musculoskeletal and rheumatological diseases required treatment. So I think the increase in the number of centres, so that there were regional centres as well as just city centres for rheumatology. Then I think the development of the nurse specialist role and the advanced nurse practitioner, and then subsequently the senior physiotherapy musculoskeletal role, these have been very important. Needless to say, the biologic therapies and the dramatic change that they've made and the continuing research into those. And of course, there's research into genetics as well. There's research into the synovium, the tendons, the entheses, all of the aspects of the joints. You know, it's so exciting that there's still so much that we need to learn. Our knowledge has increased exponentially in the last 50 years, but it's great to think that in some ways that we're not still there, that we still have so much more to learn.
And I suppose when we look back on, you know, maybe this time 3 years ago, we kind of didn't know what was ahead of us in terms of, you know, as a world, as a global community. But if we look at the Irish context, and we particularly look at people living with arthritis and rheumatology services, you know, they were all plunged into a COVID-19 pandemic and all that that entailed.
Yes.
Do you believe when the history books, you know, that the history books will be kind to us when we speak of our experiences during, you know, the pandemic and the way in which, you know, rheumatology patients and their needs were met?
I actually think history will be kind to us, because one of the interesting things about, particularly about the start of the pandemic, was that, you know, teams and hospitals and communities and GPs came together to try and solve what seemed like an insurmountable problem. So even during the severe shutdowns, you know, or lockdowns, when we couldn't physically see patients except on a super urgent basis, we still kept in touch with our patients. So we very much used the virtual technology to phone patients, to check in on them, to write prescriptions, to continue their medications, and indeed to encourage them to take their medications, because there was the sense of, oh, if I'm on an immunosuppressant therapy and there's this big virus around, maybe I shouldn't take them. So I think the fact that we could stay in touch, and sometimes those phone calls were actually very emotional, because sometimes we were the only people that those people were talking to. And the fact that we showed that we cared and that we were, you know, willing to continue this this connection with them, I think was really important. And in fact, we've continued that to some degree. So certainly patients who are stable, we don't necessarily need to drag them across the country or into hospital car parks when we actually can deliver the same message and ask the same questions virtually. Now, I don't think ultimately that the virtual system replaces the physical connection and the ability to examine the patient. But I think, you know, given the really extreme circumstances we found ourselves in, I think that I think history will be kind to us. Now, it you know, in other ways, it was very difficult. You know, I would say that in general, when I have a regular clinic and I'm seeing people face to face, I'll notice if somebody's lost weight or if they look a bit paler, or I'll notice what we call the handle door remark, where somebody, just as they're about to leave, will say the most significant thing. So those things couldn't happen during virtual visits. And I think, you know, often we will diagnose things other than their arthritis. We might, for example, diagnose a cancer or an unusual infection. And so we didn't have the ability to do that. But I think in the circumstances, the fact that we could continue to stay in touch with our patients meant a huge difference, made a huge difference.
And my last question, what do you think the future holds for rheumatology? You know, what's coming down the track?
I think the future is very exciting. When I reflect on my own career and the fact that, say, in the early 90s, there, you know, wasn't necessarily much happening from a clinical perspective, that we had no expectation that a person would go into remission, really. We had very limited medications. And then take the following decades, where there was just a huge amount of information released and a huge ability to change the lives of people. So I think there's still more that we can do. I think we don't get everybody into remission, for example. So, you know, there's still information that we need. There's still diseases that we still don't know enough about or don't have treatments for. Some of those are complex diseases, for example, scleroderma, where we don't really have effective treatments yet. And even common illnesses like osteoarthritis, we don't have good effective treatments. So there's still a lot of room to make a difference. And there is research going on in those areas that I really hope will yield fruit in the coming decades. I hope that we will get to more personalized medicine. You know, we know a lot about the genome now, and it should be possible to say, well, for one person with a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, for example, or gout, to take a different disease, that we might be able to know in advance which treatment will work, whereas now we follow an algorithm, but it's a standard algorithm as opposed to one that's personal to that patient. I think that artificial intelligence will play a role as well. It may play a role in diagnostics and also in the ability to, again, create treatment algorithms for patients that are more personalized. But I think at the end of the day, what we do best is the person-to-person contact, the doctor-patient, the nurse-patient, the health professional to patient contact is very important. I think nothing will ever supersede that. And at the end of the day, where rheumatology is about putting that jigsaw together, making good of the mystery that the patient presents with, is something that won't change. So I think all of those exciting advances will still add to what we can do as clinicians, but won't replace what we do as clinicians.
And on that positive note, I'll finish up there. And thank you very much, Professor Gay Canaan, for being with us today.
Thank you.
That's all from this episode of Inflammation Nation. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or Stitcher, or as they always say, wherever you get your podcasts. For further information about arthritis, you can visit our website, arthritisireland.ie, or contact our helpline on 0818 252 846. See you next time. Inflammation Nation is supported by Pfizer.